including the region and the world. What I would like to do is to give you an assessment of where Iraq stands today, discuss a bit how we see the way forward for U.S. policy in Iraq, what our expectations are for this year, and then invite your questions and your comments. If we look at Iraq in January 2008, and contrast it with the situation in January 2007, two areas of very significant progress come immediately to sight. On the security side, by any metric used whatsoever to measure progress, more people, more citizens of Iraq, in more places in Iraq, enjoy better security, not perfect security, but better security than at any time since the terrible outbreak of sectarian violence inspired by Al-Qaeda's bombing of the Golden Mosque in February of 2006. What are the reasons for this significant improvement? They are the conjunction of the surge of U.S. forces, five brigades to Iraq commencing in December of 2006, the application of those forces and existing forces in Iraq in a better, more coordinated, more strategic fashion to areas which had been plagued by sectarian violence in and around Baghdad, as well as other critical focal points. It is the better capacity and capabilities of the Iraqi security forces, principally the Iraqi army, to take up the fight both in direct partnership with coalition and U.S. forces, as well as increasingly in a more independent manner. It is the so-called Anbar Awakening, which is a process that has now spread well beyond Anbar province, in which Sunni elements, both tribal and non-tribal, many of whom have been engaged in violence against coalition forces, against Iraqi security forces, against elements of the Iraqi state, over the course of 2007, changed their fight to direct it against Al-Qaeda. That has had a significant and ongoing impact. And finally, it is the fragmentation. I don't say disintegration because it remains a formidable element in force, but the fragmentation of the Jaish al-Mahdi, and with it, the increasing coming out of the fight or more effective confrontation of those Shia death squads, Shia militias, largely drawn from the Jaish al-Mahdi elements, which had been engaged in violence and which were serving as an accelerant of Sunni counter-violence. All of these elements together have produced what we see today, whether we look at civilian casualties, at security force casualties, most recently and encouragingly, even the casualties our own forces are taking in Iraq, which had surged during much of 2007. The numbers are down. They are down progressively. It has been a continuing slope beginning in late December 2006 and continuing very much through 2007. The other area where progress has been made is on the economic side. The Iraqi government, which had through 2006 been largely incapable of executing a capital infrastructure budget, despite its considerable reservoirs of revenues, its current account surplus in the 10 billion plus range, has now moved to a much better record of performance. Obligations and commitments of central government funds have improved dramatically over 2006. What is critical now is that beyond obligation and commitment of funds, actual expenditures move on the ground. That is translation of obligations into actual projects that are of benefit to the Iraqi people. We have worked hard and long with the Iraqi ministries concerned to develop an execution capability. This is absolutely essential, and I will give you a real-world example of where it comes into the fight, into the security situation. As security stabilized in Anbar province, the most violent of all of the so-called kinetic areas of Iraq, provincial government, which we and others in the coalition had been working with even when it was in exile in Baghdad, returned to Anbar, as did local governments outside the capital of the province. And when they returned, they brought with them a carefully crafted list of development projects and needs. Because the central government was better prepared to provide funding, to execute funding for the provinces as well as for central government ministerial functions, they were able to respond quite quickly to Anbar's need for funding. Now the challenge is on the local government's structures in Anbar to actually take that money and to apply it to the projects they have identified on the ground. But there is a very positive synergy here between efforts to strengthen central government economic capacity and local governance and its capacity to develop project priorities and then to implement those projects. So, a good record, a quite strikingly positive record on security, an improving record on economic performance. The lagging indicator, as economists would say, in all of this is the national political process, particularly the national dialogue which must contribute over time to the advancement of national reconciliation. When Ambassador Crocker, when General Petraeus spoke in September to the American Congress, they talked about practical accommodations, practical arrangements taking place on the ground that substituted to an extent for a still absent process of national dialogue, national reconciliation, and they spoke quite accurately to that positive phenomenon. But the absence of progress on the national political front, the absence of significant progress in beginning the process, and I speak carefully of beginning the process, because Iraq, frankly, is in the state of revolutionary transformation, and revolutions don't tend to run on a neat timetable or according to PowerPoints or neat matrices, however carefully we may all construct them, but a beginning of the process that leads to true national reconciliation, a definition of what it means to be an Iraqi of what Iraq means, must move forward. And it cannot be based solely upon pragmatic or practical accommodations at local levels, however useful. So we have placed our focus in the latter part of 2007, and our focus will certainly be during the course of 2008, on helping to move the government, and by government I mean all of the political structures that comprise the so-called 3+1, the Iraqi presidency, the Kurdish president, the Shia vice president, Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Sunni vice president, Tariq al-Hashimi, with the partnership of Prime Minister Maliki, and then the group of five, those aforementioned four, plus Masoud Barzani, the president of Kurdish regional government, into more effective, more collaborative, more collegial work, to try to form a center of political mass, not a consensus, but a center of political mass, because there will always be those whose views take them outside that center. But a center which is capable of translating itself into effective parliamentary action, to the passage of key legislation, to the advancement of the building blocks that over time should be, can be, must be the foundation of national reconciliation. I am cautiously, guardedly more optimistic today than I would have been in speaking to you perhaps 90 days ago, 120 days ago, on the prospects for this process. It is a slow, grinding effort to focus the attention of all Iraq's elites, not on their particularist partisan agendas, but on a forming national agenda. But progress there has been. In December, the Iraqi Council of Representatives, which is very much in the end responsive to the directions of the key political blocs and their leaderships, moved on a pensions law which contained quite dramatic reintegration of elements of the Sunni community who had been stripped of benefits by the initial actions of Iraq's de-Ba'athification laws. A 2008 budget, which we expect will pass at any day now, was also devised and agreed upon in December. It's quite an extraordinary document. It is very much a national budget. It includes significantly increased funding for Iraq's own security obligations. It contains dramatically increased funding for capital investment, as well as for provincial governance. All of these are positive developments, and it was an Iraqi product. They developed it, they debated it, they will execute it. But more is needed. This month, the Iraqi Council of Representatives, after a leadership agreement, passed a de-Ba'athification reform law. It is not a perfect law in that it does not reflect the maximum desires of all who were involved in its passage. Very few pieces of legislation in any parliamentary process are perfect by that definition. What it does represent is a significant and positive compromise, a reflection of a significant center, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, which now needs to be implemented in the spirit in which it was ostensibly passed, one of reconciliation and unification rather than further division and exclusion. We think this is a very positive step forward, and we will welcome its expected passage or ratification through the Presidency Council in the days ahead. The next items on Iraq's leadership agenda are the passage of a provincial powers law. Now, this is not simply a normal piece of legislation. It is the beginning of the definition of what a federal structure means in Iraq, of what the relationship between center and periphery is to be. It is not, cannot, and should not be an attempt at defining for all time what that structure is. In the United States and other countries with a federal system, there is a constant process of evolution. As circumstances change, the direction of the structures of a federal system change with them. But what is needed in Iraq today is a foundation. It is a balance struck which is right as can be gotten for today. And as Iraq changes over the years ahead, these structures should change with them. But the absence of an agreement for now on what are to be the practical relationships between the center and provinces and regions is a glaring one, and it affects other critical developments, to wit, the passage of a provincial election law. Iraq's provincial governments are distorted, are imbalanced by two critical factors. First, the boycott of Sunnis from the process when the initial elections were held for local government. And secondly, the changes that have taken place, positive changes that have taken place in Iraq, not just in Sunni communities, but also in other areas since 2005. There is a demand at the popular level for rectification of these imbalances. There is a demand for a more direct relationship between elector and elected official, which a national closed list in which people vote for symbols or numbers cannot provide. And so a good progressive electoral law, which moves in the direction of an open list in which voters identify with specific representatives, is something which we believe needs to be done and for which there is a very significant popular demand. Now, elections themselves must occur before the end of the year to stabilize the situation, to rectify the current imbalances on the ground. That too will be a challenge for Iraq's government, but a challenge that we believe can and should be made. Hydrocarbons, not least, because I list it last, is the need for a modern national hydrocarbons law. Iraq, people of Iraq, will never be able to benefit to the maximum extent possible from petroleum, which provides now some 94% of their national revenues, in the absence of a progressive national hydrocarbon law. It is very important that Iraq get this law right. There are debates ongoing between those who would take Iraq in the direction of a quite liberal production sharing arrangement based law and those who would hold to a classic status d'origine structure in which all resources were held tightly within the central government. A balance here needs to be struck. Iraq is not alone in confronting this debate. But the benefits of a progressive law have been demonstrated around the world, and we believe will certainly be demonstrated in Iraq as well. My colleague, the Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs, is in Iraq now. He is focusing his mission on working with the Kurdish regional government and with the government of Iraq, the central government, in trying to devise a way forward on hydrocarbons. This is an essential next step for Iraq. We are very concerned at unilateral actions by the Kurdish regional government in offering contracts outside the presence of a national law. We do not believe that is a road down which the Kurdish regional government either ought to go or, if progressed on, will benefit that government. Major companies will only do business in the context of a national law, not an independent, unilateral set of structures offered by one of Iraq's regions. So an important priority. Finally, on the level of our bilateral U.S.-Iraqi relationship, at the concluding part of last year, we negotiated with the government of Iraq a declaration of principles that laid out goals for both of our countries to be fulfilled in the course of 2008 that will establish a sovereign state-to-sovereign state relationship between our two countries and provide a basis for the presence of U.S. forces, for the presence of the multinational force, beyond the anticipated and hoped for termination of the Chapter 7 mandate under which those forces operate today, no later than December 31st of this year. This is a significant challenge, but it is an important challenge. It is a step towards Iraq's full assumption of responsibility and sovereignty, beyond the nominal to the realm of the real. We look forward to starting these negotiations next month. They will take place on several different levels. We will be negotiating security arrangements, a status of forces agreement. We will also be negotiating arrangements on the scientific, cultural, social, economic side, as well as a political relationship which we believe will serve both of our countries beyond 2008. These arrangements will be either paralleled by, we anticipate, or can be joined in by other coalition partners. But this is a process absolutely essential for the future of Iraq. It is part of the definition of what Iraq will be, the nature of how its security will be assured over the years, plural, to come, because we are speaking here of a long-term commitment and the goal of a long-term relationship. My last note will be on Iraq's neighbors. It is, in our view, extremely important, and I think this is a view shared by the United Kingdom, that Iraq's neighbors play a part in the securing, stabilization of an Iraq which ultimately can become a source of peace for the region and not a source of division and violence. It is not appropriate, it is not helpful, that the largest diplomatic presence in Iraq is that of the government of Iran, and that Arab governments, those of Iraq's neighbors and others in the region, are almost entirely absent. Iraq must not become, should not become, a confrontation point for Arabs and Persians, or for Shia and Sunni. It should become what we hope that it is, a nation sovereign unto itself, not a pawn in other broader regional or extra-regional challenges. But for this to become Iraq's true future, Iraq's neighbors must play their part, all of them. We look forward to a constructive, cooperative engagement by and physical presence, diplomatic presence of Iraq's Arab neighbors and others in the region. With respect to the government of Iran, Iran continues its lethal support through training, through equipment, of the most violent, most radical groups in Iraq's Shia community. That must stop. We are prepared for discussions along with the government of Iraq in Baghdad with the government of Iran at any time that the government of Iran indicates its willingness to do so. For the past 2 months, that offer has been pending. The government of Iran has not responded. But we will remain ready for those discussions. We would hope that Iran, too, can become a positive force in and with respect to Iraq, but that has not been the conduct of the Iranian government since 2003. One always hopes that change here is possible. We are cautiously optimistic about the future of Iraq. We don't understate or minimize the challenges today and the challenges that will be ahead. But we see progress, and progress should be acknowledged where it exists, where the challenges remain. We see the possibility of successful addressal of those challenges. We want this government of Iraq to succeed, but for that to happen, it must govern more effectively and it must govern in a national manner. That will continue to be our message as we press ahead. Thank you.
Ambassador, that was quite fantastic, and not only was it the content brilliant, but you stopped at 6:30. Yeah. Unbelievable. Now, you kindly agreed to answer some questions until 7 o'clock. So, who would like to begin? If nobody else will, you, sir. Would you?
If you could please identify yourselves with questions.
Name and your any organisation you represent. That would be helpful.
Please.
I am a career diplomat, and an exercise of diplomacy is to know when to be discreet in answering a question. I won't speculate, cannot speculate, on the intentions or the policies that might be carried out by any of those who will form the next administration, but what I can speak to is the impact of the domestic debate in the United States on this administration, for which I am responsible. Our policies, the direction that we will follow now and through January 20th, of next year will be based upon our best assessment of the circumstances on the ground, the interests of the United States, and how, in light of the circumstances as we assess them in Iraq, to see those interests secured and advanced not just for the period from today to noon on January 20th, but for the long term beyond. And that will be our approach until the day the administration leaves office, at which point the next administration, we have every confidence, will reflect upon those interests, those long-term equities of the United States in reaching its own decisions on how it wishes to proceed.
Thank you.
David
Lord Hannay.
Very good to see you.
Nice to see you again. Kurdish regional government, PKK, Kirkuk, do you think that we're just in a very temporary lull now in the winter, that bad things will start happening again when the snows thaw? And could you just say a bit about what the United States is doing with the government of Turkey and the Kurdish regional government, and also how the problem could be given by the place on the parking slot?
Certainly. I've just come on Saturday from Ankara, where I had discussions on exactly these subjects with the Turkish general staff as well as with the Turkish civilian political leadership. The United States has, over the course of the last 60 days, entered into a quite extraordinary partnership with the Turkish government, with the Turkish general staff, designed at helping to facilitate the addressal of the threat posed by this terrorist organization, the PKK, to the innocent citizens of Turkey. Too many Turks continue to die from PKK terrorism. It is not an issue that my country can or will ignore. And we have been working with the government of Turkey in a quite substantive manner to better enable them, from the standpoint of security undertakings, to address the specific challenge posed by PKK terrorists. However, the kinetic, the security dimension of how one deals with the challenge of the PKK is but one dimension in what must be a comprehensive approach. A comprehensive approach which includes elements beyond or in addition to the military, the security, the kinetic. That is our view. It is also the view expressed back to us by the Turkish general staff, as well as by Turkey's political leadership, President Gül, Prime Minister Erdogan. We are encouraged by that. This does represent a significant recognition on the part of the Turkish military as well as civilian leadership that while kinetic operations are important, indeed essential, there must be other dimensions to the approach in dealing with this problem. Now, there are requirements that go beyond that placed upon the Turkish government here. The Kurdish regional government has a major responsibility that it must seriously and in a sustained manner undertake. We have made very clear, particularly to President Barzani, the importance of dealing with the PKK as what it is, a terrorist organization which has killed many Kurdish citizens, including elements of his own Peshmerga and KDP, and which represents a long-term challenge, a long-standing challenge to the stability of his region. It's important that the KRG be unequivocal in the way it treats this issue, both on the ground in terms of constraining the ability to move and to facilitate access and supplies to the PKK, as well as the public statements that are made. There should be no ambiguity about the position of the KDP or the KRG on this issue. And President Talabani has certainly made very clear his view, as President of Iraq, as well as the leader of the PUK, that the PKK is a terrorist organization and a threat to Kurds. We would hope that President Barzani would be equally clear and unequivocal in his messages and in his actions. I don't, frankly, see a lull for the winter season. Turkish operations have continued on a sustained basis throughout the last 30 days. I have every expectation they will continue. The winter is not a bar to these kinds of undertakings. And, of course, focus must be made upon what will occur in the spring, when typically PKK activities resume. But I would underscore, a comprehensive approach must be placed here. The Turkish government and the Turkish general staff are in agreement on that, but it's execution that must move forward. Article 140, which is actually, although the shorthand name is the Kirkuk resolution, its scope is far broader than just Kirkuk. It covers all disputed boundary arrangements within Iraq. We are very pleased by the engagement of the United Nations through the new Special Representative, the Secretary General, Staffan de Mistura, in taking on, with the formal concurrence of the Kurdish regional government as well as the government of Iraq, with our very strong encouragement and backing, a process to address this issue in a manner which will, at its end, produce a true consensus outcome. The United States does not wish to see an outcome to Article 140, which is dictated unilaterally by any side. We don't want to see an outcome which will have the purpose of dividing and serving as an accelerant of violence rather than the opposite. We don't know how long this process will take. There has to be substantive movement along the way for all sides' purposes. But as long as it does take, the time and the space should be given to work for an outcome here which will be unifying and calming rather than dividing and a source of violence. We already see elements of the old Ba'ath and al-Qaeda rallying in Mosul, in Kirkuk, around the theme of Kurdish unilateral actions directed against the interests of the Sunni community. This is not helpful. And that is a message we have delivered very directly to our friends in the KRG. But we are pleased at this step forward by the UN. There's a vital role there which we will support them in playing.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
I've got two questions, one of which was to do with Kurdistan. And we do hear quite a lot about a general feeling that maybe one way out is to give independence to Kurdistan and how this is going to affect not just Iraq but the rest of the countries around. And my second question is, you spoke about the neighbors and you spoke about Iran and the Libyans, but you didn't speak about Syria. Mm-hmm. Have you had a deal with Syria or not? Thank you.
With respect to the issue of independence for Kurdistan, I can't do more than to quote Masoud Barzani, who has said repeatedly that Kurds, like all people, have dreams, but dreams must reflect reality. And the reality is that an independent Kurdistan would be instantly the target of every one of its neighbors, including Iraq to its south. That the Kurds see their interests in the Kurdish regional governments area as part of Iraq, with Baghdad as their capital. And I think the events of the last several months with respect to the PKK in Turkey have powerfully reminded the Kurdish regional government of the benefits they have in being part of a broader state and not truly on their own. I don't think a unilateral independence, as opposed to the current autonomy enjoyed under the constitution of Iraq, is the direction which the Kurdish leadership will take of their area. With respect to Syria, Syria certainly has not played a positive role with respect to facilitation of violence in Iraq. Syria remains the primary source for al-Qaeda's suicide bombers for the foreign fighter flow into Iraq. It is a source which has, in an absolute sense, diminished somewhat over recent months, but that diminution in the volume of foreign fighters coming through Syria, we do not attribute to an altruistic intent by the government of Syria, but rather to concerns within Syria about the consequences for domestic stability and regime stability by the kinds of very dangerous elements transiting through and residing within their country. It is also the consequence of much better operations within Iraq that make the environment for al-Qaeda's operations much more hazardous, much riskier, much more difficult to achieve success within. We would very much like to see Syria be a constructive neighbor of Iraq, and there too the door to dialogue remains open. Secretary of State has met twice with Walid Mualim and has made these views very clear. But we have not seen the Syrian government on this area as well as on other critical areas, Lebanon and Syria's blockage of presidential elections, the Palestinian issue where radical Palestinians continue to be harbored in and supported by the Syrian government, or in its relationship with Iran and Hezbollah as a positive contributor to peace and stability in the Middle East, although that is certainly what we would hope for Syria.
Bruce Hans.
As you would, I think, agree, Ambassador, under General Petraeus, we're at last winning the war, and the hopes and dreams of 2003 are being realized, so it is working. Can we revisit history? It seems to all of us Brits that Paul Bremer, Jerry Bremer, an absolute catastrophe by imposing the Iraqi armed forces by departmenting civil service. He almost lost Iraq. And if a more sophisticated and subtle policy had been pursued from the beginning, this would not have happened. I imagine you might regard that question as well as controversial.
Bruce, you failed to identify yourself. You need to do this. Thank you.
One of the very few joys of my job is that I do not have to take responsibility for decisions that were taken prior to my own tenure. And historians are writing and will continue, no doubt, to write about what took place in those initial years. And certainly we have acknowledged quite clearly that mistakes, very substantive mistakes, were made. But again, my focus is on how to move this process forward, not on looking back at what was or was not done correctly. There would be more than enough time and space for that particular endeavor to be pursued.
This line is from the hospital from the former minister for the meeting. Mm-hmm. Syria was mentioned a moment or two ago. One problem, of course, is that there are so many refugees in Syria at the moment, from over a billion, some say as many as 1.5 million. But the responsibility for this seems to be well split between Baghdad and actually Jordan, where there's another half million. What role do you think the United States can play in trying to bring some sort of humanitarian solution to the problem around the refugees? And you mentioned, I think you said, that the Kurdish regional government offering contracts was, in your view, entirely wrong. I'm slightly perplexed by that because we've all been concentrating on the Basra Development Fund as well, which I had imagined was going to be empowered to give some contracts, and the Prime Minister in this country has been encouraging us all to get behind the Basra Development Fund. I mean, do you take the same view of the contracts based in Basra and in the South as you do about what's going on in the world?
The answer to your first question, there is one fundamental way, and certainly the U.S. has a major contribution here, to resolving the plight of the externally displaced, the refugees in Syria and Jordan. And that is to do all that we can to stabilize circumstances inside Iraq so those individuals will return. This is not a classic refugee population. They don't live in tents. There aren't feeding stations. There are very few relative to their mass have sought out UNHCR to register for services. They want to come back. They won't come back unless they feel they can do so safely. And when they come back, as some are, and the degree of return is problematic in terms of absolute numbers, but there definitely has been an increase in returnees from Jordan and Syria. But as they return, they will present another problem that those who have worked the Balkans will be quite familiar with. When you have displaced populations coming home, if they cannot return, as is usually the case in these conflicts, to their homes, what compensation arrangements are put in place? Where do they go? How are they housed? How are they accommodated in a way that does not create yet another threat to stability, yet another accelerant for violence along ethnic or sectarian lines? And the government of Iraq has a major responsibility in setting up structures to deal with these returnees. It has been very slow to respond to this challenge. As they remain externally displaced, though, the U.S. takes quite seriously our humanitarian responsibilities. We are the largest single state contributor to UNHCR efforts. We are accelerating our own intake of refugees quite dramatically over the course of 2008, but that is not the resolution, should not be seen as the resolution to this issue. It is bringing these people back to their country and not turning temporarily displaced into permanent refugees with all of the consequences that means, both for the states in which they have sought first asylum as well as for states to which they may ultimately wish to move. With respect to contracting, I want to be quite clear. We do not believe there should be unilateral oil contracting outside the context of the national government and a national hydrocarbon law. With respect to other contracting endeavors, the field is wide open.
Mm-hmm. You, sir.
My name is Henry Sinnott. I have some involvement in the Coalition for Regional Authority in Southern Iraq. Ambassador, thank you very much for the presentation. You referred to General Petraeus' testimony to the House in September. And part of that struck me at the time. Senator Warner asked him the question, what is the effect? General, do you think the American engagement in Iraq has enhanced the safety of America? And I recall his answer, I think, more exactly, and it was, "Sir, actually, I don't know." I wonder whether you, sir, as a career diplomat, 4 months later, can be any more specific.
I will respond in this way. I do believe that the progressive establishment of a stable, secure, and peaceful Iraq as a growingly, increasingly multi-sectarian, multi-ethnic, democratic, unified entity will indeed contribute to the long-term interests of the United States in the Middle East and beyond. And the contrary is also true. I believe that if Iraq fails to move in that direction, that there will be a long-term threat and challenge posed well beyond Iraq and its boundaries to our partners and friends in the region and beyond.
Thank you. Joseph.
Ambassador, my name is Mohammed Mollam from the NEC. You can see from your presentation that you have a certain amount of satisfaction with the performance of the Iraqi government. And so far, we haven't seen a lot of progress in terms of the internal reconciliation. You also have talked about the role of the neighboring country. And I don't believe that physical existence is the only thing that is required. Lots of things that can be done.
Absolutely.
So the question is, if the Iraqi government is performing well so far in terms of helping to improve the security, how can neighboring countries help in pushing the reconciliation path?
By engaging in and with Iraq, by not questioning the legitimacy of Iraq's institutions, by not challenging whether or not Iraq as a demographically representative state, reflecting its demographic Shia majority and its democratic structures, is a transitory phenomenon en route to a restoration of a Sunni regime, or whether it is in fact a positive thing for the Middle East. Whether Iraq is to be cast for all eternity as a ground of confrontation between Persians and Arabs, Safavids and Arabs, or between Shia and Sunni, that's a terrible vision. It's been a terrible past, which has not helped the security or stability of the Middle East. It is by engaging economically, it is by engaging diplomatically, it is by encouraging the government of Iraq to move forward, it's by engaging with the Sunni community of Iraq to help them move further in the direction they've already chosen. Chosen, I would note, on their own and with very little support from outside in turning away from another major threat to the region, Sunni Islamist extremism, and the threat it poses. These are the kinds of ways all of Iraq's neighbors can help. This was the message of the president when he met in Cairo with President Mubarak. It's the message of the president when he met in the Gulf as well, and it will continue to be our encouragement and exhortation to Iraq's neighbors. We understand the real concern, which we share, about the threat posed by Iran's expansionist hegemonistic ambitions in Iraq and beyond. But the way to address them is not by turning the back to Iraq and allowing only Iran to be represented and to play there. It is by constructively engaging with this government and helping it move forward.
The Kuwaiti ambassador.
Thank you, Ted. Thank you. Thank you, Ambassador. It was so fascinating. You know, one of the neighboring countries of Iraq concerning what you mentioned, and I agree with you that the Arab absence of Iraq, the Arab region, and the Iranian influence. But really, you know, what concerns us now in Iran these days. You see that the militia, you mentioned that, you have this militia, you have Hezbollah Fadila and the Peshmerga in the north. And now, after the surge, where the Americans have provided the Sunnis tribes in the middle with a lot of weapons to fight Al-Qaeda, and they succeeded, which is good, you know, we see now that it's blessed them. But they kept the weapons in their hands. How do you see the situation, you know, with all of these militias in Iraq? Do you think that this will be a strength to the government, or they will undermine, you know, and they will have a big impact on the political process, as you say?
Ambassador, the U.S. government, the U.S. military, have given not a single weapon to any of the so-called Lejan Shabia popular committees, or we call them concerned local citizens. They were well-armed to begin with. And we very specifically, have declined to provide any arms to them. The number of those concerned local citizens is about 80,000. They're scattered throughout Iraq, primarily in the largely Sunni provinces or mixed provinces with a large Sunni population. It is our intent that there be no concerned local citizens, no Lejan Shabia, as rapidly as possible. Only about 20% of those people have a future in the security services of Iraq. The rest need civilian employment. The resolution here is for the government of Iraq, as happens in virtually any post-conflict state, to reach out, to integrate these individuals into the life of the state, to take them out from and away from violence over the time ahead. Now, that's happened in Anbar, where the Iraqi government has incorporated elements of the popular committees of Anbar into the security forces, into the civilian workforce. But it needs to continue, and it is most sensitive and most important, not in Sunni provinces, but in mixed areas like Diyala, like Salah ad-Din, where empowering Sunnis by employment means balancing an imbalanced situation on the ground. No, the United States does not see a militia-based future for Iraq. This would be a very negative development. But the Iraqi government must face its own responsibilities in bringing to a close this transitional structure, because that is exactly how we view it, a transitional, temporary structure, and bringing it into the life of the state.
How they would be able to take all of these weapons from the militia, now they are in the securities, you know, even not in the army.
Well, the challenge posed by all of the armed elements outside government control is a significant one, and ultimately, Iraq will need a full-blown DDR process, demobilization, disarmament, reintegration. Paradoxically, the reintegration part has actually jumped over the full demobilization and disarmament, which is a rather extraordinary development. But those other pieces will ultimately need to catch up as well.
Mm-hmm. You, and then you at the back.
Yes, a few pieces that concern the shadow of the foreign. Ambassador, the United States government is already fully committed to Iraq. It's fully committed to Afghanistan. In terms of the State Department, the DOE and the other agencies, what actual translation of lessons and experience goes on between Iraq and Afghanistan? I know their circumstances are different, but in many respects, for all the approaches, the institutions, the problems are almost the same. Is there a cross-fertilization, or are they in different silos?
While I am not responsible for nor an expert on Afghanistan or its challenges, one of the lessons learned from Iraq has been the experience of the provincial reconstruction teams, which is to have the maximum degree of physical presence, outreach, in as many areas outside the capital as possible, to facilitate local civil society, local government, to act in the maximum degree of coordination and cooperation with military forces in maximizing what we both do in terms of civil affairs efforts, kinetic and post-kinetic stabilization efforts. That has been an extraordinarily important lesson of Iraq. It is a radically new approach for us. It's an approach which my government was ill-equipped from the standpoint of staffing and expertise to take on. We have scrambled over the last 7 months to find the hundreds of personnel necessary to man these provincial reconstruction teams. We have gone from 10 to 28 in Iraq. Some 400 people have been surged over a very brief period of time. And this is something that we take away as a government as a long-term challenge. We don't want to have to deal with the challenges posed by man-made or natural disaster on an endlessly ad hoc basis. And so we are looking at the concept of a civilian reserve corps, which will have the expertise necessary at making the skill sets in our own diplomatic service more suitable for these kinds of challenges, because the challenges will not go away with a resolution in Iraq or Afghanistan. They will continue in different forms, in different places, not always the result of conflict, but they will continue. But that has been a major takeaway. The other is, when one is dealing with a security threat, the focus cannot be on transition. It needs to be on dealing with the threat, with an appropriate and careful application of the various forces necessary, kinetic, economic, and political. Transition comes when true stabilization has been achieved. It can't precede it.
I think we have time for two more quick questions. The gentleman in the corner, and then the lady there, and then we'll wrap it up. Gentleman in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Elaborate a little bit on the reintegration of the Baathists or the
what you think actually what will happen by the process of the rebathification or the rebathification reform.
Please don't call it rebathification. That is absolutely not what the intent of this law is. The Ba'ath was a scourge. It is a scourge for every country it has touched, and Iraq no less than Syria today. But what we hope to be the outcome is this. We hope the execution, the implementation of this law, is to bring back into the life of the state, whether in private sector or public sector, some 30,000 of individuals, many of whom may not seek to come back into national life, may simply wish to draw their pension. It is the ability through the operation of this law for many more thousands of families, not the individual who was the object of de-ba'athification himself, but the families of those individuals to draw benefits. That's the expected outcome. That's what a unifying, reconciling execution and implementation of this law will mean. It is not envisioned, and we certainly will work to assure it is not used, as yet another weapon, perhaps with a different size blade and a different degree of sharpness, to further exclude and further divide.
Lady there, in the middle.
Now, as an Iraqi, I would like to know your expectations for the next general elections in Iraq. Or let's say for the next 4 years.
Let's say this. Our expectations are what we think are the expectations of the people of Iraq, which is a free, fair, and representative national election, which empowers a representative national government that reflects both in its composition as well as in its conduct the interests of all of Iraq's citizens. That's our hope. That's our expectation. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done by Iraqis between now and then. Well, I think in my earlier remarks, what I said is Iraq has to define. There is a federal system in Iraq. That's what Iraq's constitution provides for. The Kurdish region is the first embodiment of that federal potential of Iraq. But how federalism is further defined is the very subject of the provincial powers law now under deliberation. And it is very active deliberation. One of the lessons of the last year has been there are no monolithic blocks in Iraq. The Shia respond differently across party lines and within parties to different issues. So do the Sunnis. There is no single solution that one can say this is what the Sunni community wishes, this is what the Shia community wishes, and that's positive. It makes things much more complicated, but it is what happens in processes that allow free debate, and out of the turmoil, the dynamic of that debate comes, we think and we hope, a better outcome than if monolithic blocks decide for everyone who falls within their ethnic or sectarian identity a potential outcome. And that's been a positive development, which Iraq itself, which Iraqis themselves, have evolved over the past year. And the answer to your question will be evolved by Iraqis as well. There's no right or wrong answer here, but there must be an answer. This gray area must be clarified for now. But then that answer will evolve and will change in the time ahead.
Ambassador, at the beginning of this meeting, I said that you were the perfect person to speak to us on Iraq, on US policy on Iraq. But that was before I heard you speak. I am relieved to say that you have been kind enough to prove me right. Thank you for a very nuanced, highly informed and fascinating talk about an area which will be of increasing importance and is of great importance to this country. Ambassador, thank you very much.
Thank you.